Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Brother Richard is back with another book, which is more balm for the soul. It's called Calming the Storms and it is literally just what the doctor ordered for the modern world. He'll be joining me in studio. I'll also be meeting Dr. Sally Bramley, who went from NHS doctor to integrative and functional practitioner. She'll be discussing that change and the results of my checkup. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, this week was a bit of a struggle, I have to be honest with you. I was sick last week and kind of pushed through the end of the week with work stuff, but I felt like I was turning a corner and I had to get back to the world. It felt for all intents and purposes like I had a bad head cold. And look, by day five, I did feel like the world was ready for me, but I hugged no one. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, we are forever changed by that pandemic. You can't have a virus now without there being some sort of guilt and shame and absolute awareness for going back out into the world. I didn't label it, test it, and I felt I was cautious. But I think because I pushed myself through last week, I paid for it by being utterly exhausted this week. Literally, daily tasks felt like swimming through tarmac. I dropped the gym sessions to allow myself to rest. And then I find if I'm not exercising in the day, that impacts on my sleep. And it was literally a vicious, vicious cycle that went on and on. But thankfully, it seems to have passed somewhat. But I have been so frustrated. Why can't we just allow our body what it needs? I know, obviously, work and family life rumbles on. So days in complete bed rest are kept for hospital visits alone, let's face it. But I struggled to do as little as possible. Took a few walks, though, I will say, and autumn is a feast for the eyes. This is your cue to head out today if you can and drink it all in. Now, I want to give a mention to an event that is happening this week. It's on in the Helix in Dublin. It is called Change is Possible. It's being organised by the incredible Brian Penny, who went from, in a nutshell, heroin addict to neuroscientist, and is just an incredible person to know and to witness. So he is holding this event and all of the proceeds are going to Lust for Life, who do huge amounts in the areas of mental health for young people. He's going to be joined by Neil O'Murricu. He's going to be joined by Anna Geary and Dermot Whelan. So it is a fantastic night. All the proceeds, as I say, are going to Lust for Life, and you can get your tickets at the Helix website. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, True Health are a doctor-led team specialising in digestive issues, stress and burnout, helping clients understand what's going on in their body and why. Dr. Sally Bramley is Chief Medical Officer, having moved from working in the NHS to integrative and functional medicine, and she joins me in studio now. Well, Sally, you're very welcome.
It's wonderful to be here, Claire.
So tell us a little bit about that transition from traditional, conventional medicine and let people know what integrative and functional is.
So like many people that enter the integrative space, I did have my own health journey, which started when I was in medical school. I was studying for exams at the time, so I was quite stressed. And I actually woke up one morning and was quite unwell, so I was actually coughing up blood. And that resulted in me being admitted to hospital. And what unfolded was quite a lot of uncertainty in terms of the diagnosis. I was looking quite well, but what the doctors were telling me was that it could be something even potentially life-threatening. And as a medical student as well, I was very much in that diagnostic mode of what is this? I desperately wanted to have an answer. And it made me realize how much I really valued my health, how important it was to me. And it wasn't until I made that switch from actually asking what is this to starting to ask why. Like, why has this happened in the first place? And I realized, you know, I could see all those factors of stress and my lifestyle and making simple shifts, starting meditating, changing what I was eating, that had big impacts, not just on my health, but across my whole life. So I became very passionate exploring what is this wider context in which we live and how does that really support our overall health.
So what was your eventual diagnosis?
So they did eventually diagnose it as tuberculosis, but what that wasn't fully confirmed in any way. So always still that question mark over the head, but I did receive full 6 months of treatment for that.
Wow. So the coughing of the blood disappeared, but you really wanted to know what led to that. And that's something I'm always really fascinated about, that we work in a crisis model currently. So we wait for something to go wrong. Then we go, we treat the symptoms. And, you know, I think it's really important, and I'm sure you'll say the same, we don't need to pit these things against each other. We need conventional medicine. It has helped us to live longer and healthier than ever before. And there are incredible people working within it. But we rarely ask those questions that you're talking about. What led to this, and how can we make little tweaks in our life to ensure that this doesn't happen again?
Exactly that. And I really can't stress enough, I really received world-class care. The doctors were all fantastic, the treatment I received. But when I actually looked at the other things going on in my life, like living on a very moldy boat, and I was in elective in South Africa, was exposed to tuberculosis and things like that. So if I'd have had these things in mind about being more protective for my health and the different things contributing to it, then it probably would have been avoided.
So what is integrative and functional medicine?
So integrative medicine, I see it as how can we find the very best tool to support with someone where they're at? Because what we've seen in recent years is this shift from these more sudden illnesses, infections and emergencies to these more longer term conditions, things like diabetes, depression, back pain, low energy. And that's putting such a strain on our healthcare system. And actually, it's often not best managed by medicines because we're not addressing those underlying root causes. And actually what I found, once we start addressing that why, these conditions which we previously thought were lifelong are in fact reversible. And that still, as a medical trained doctor, really blows my mind to see the changes that people can go through.
And it's not easy though, is it? And I just think that's really important that we stress that to people. It's not like this magic wand that you suddenly say, listen, you're stressed, and all of a sudden, you know, the things in your life that are causing you stress are all just going to magically disappear. But it's not a quick fix. When you work with clients now, tell us a little bit about the journey you go on with them.
So, I mean, in some cases, it can be a quick fix. It does happen, particularly with nutrition, because some of the things we're feeding ourselves with now are just, our bodies are incredible at self-healing. And all we need to do sometimes is remove the barriers to that, because if we're currently bombarding them things which are causing inflammation or continuing to get in the way of that healing response, then actually the body can sort itself out quite quickly. But what's important in terms of that longer journey that you're referring to is that actually we need to look at these wider factors, otherwise it does tend to just reoccur. So for example, why is it that I'm eating these unhealthy foods in the first place? Is it because I'm overburdened with stress and I have that tendency to overeat? So what we find is that if people do just do the one test, quick fix, then eventually these condition patterns reoccur. So that's why we do speak about this longer health journey of self-discovery and really, yeah, tuning into what are all these factors I need to look at.
Now, you kindly invited me to come to yourself to go on this journey and have a health screening. And I was really impressed that it started with, I think we were on a Zoom for an hour, were we? We really delved into my medical history and the way I was living and the decisions I was making and my past, my present. And that can be missing. I mean, I actually have an incredible GP who has a very holistic view of life, and she's always talking about areas of life as well as prescriptions. But that isn't the norm, is it?
It's not. And I really see my role as the doctor in this position is to help someone make sense of their symptoms. I think that's really an important part of actually that healing journey and overcoming things. And even with my own experience, I really crave that, because as a doctor, the word is hemoptysis. But actually for me, now experiencing it on the other side, no, I wanted that person to understand what it was like to wake up and be breathing through liquid and those kind of words. And the way I was describing it was really important for me to actually make sense of what was going on. So it's supporting people to really weave together everything that's happened even before they were born, that we'll go into that, and how was the health of their mum in the womb and all through their early life, everything that contributes to this current moment and what they're experiencing.
And what you suggested for me was twofold. Now, I didn't need to get my bloods done. I'd recently had them done with the GP. I sent you those. Is that something you'd ask for Are bloods an important indicator of health?
So we do like that deep investigative dive. So if anybody has any previous tests or letters, like we're collecting as much data as possible on someone's health, both on that subjective side that I mentioned, but also on these really, I mean, that is the integrative approach. It's weaving together this ancient wisdom that we've almost lost in terms of what really supports someone's health with the very forefront of modern medicine, science, the tests that are now available. In terms of the next steps, we do offer people that initial 10-minute discovery course so they can start to get an idea of what kind of other tests might be relevant for them.
So what I was prescribed was a look at my saliva and my stools. Warning if you're having your breakfast. We won't delve too deeply into it, but what can you tell from both of those?
So the stool test is one of my very favourites because the gut is absolutely a foundation for health. And this really is the opportunity to get to know your unique microbiome because it's completely different in everybody's case. But what we can tell is these particular patterns which really represent health, as we saw in yours, Claire, that real diversity, that flourishing beneficial species like the Firmicutes. And then we're also checking as well on some of the gut function. So we're looking at digestion, we're looking at how the immune system's functioning, whether there's any inflammation, and then we're also looking at what the microbiota are producing. So these are such a foundation for health because they have so many crucial roles in the body, producing various breakdown products that influence the gut lining. They go up to the brain to influence how we're feeling, our mood, our immune system, and we can start to also assess some of those, which is really fascinating.
And the saliva?
And then for the saliva test, so there's a lot of focus now on stress, cortisol, and we're actually able to test that at various time points. So you should have this normal curve where cortisol is high in the morning and then it goes low throughout the day towards the night. And even though it's a stress hormone, it's also really important as our get up and go energizing, like I'm going to rock this day hormone. And what we find is when people are actually exposed to chronic stress for a very long time, then the pattern of cortisol can actually drop too low. So what it allows us to do is to match the stress intervention to what stage they're actually up to.
So with the stool samples, for example, you give 3 days, isn't that right? I think I've blocked it from my mind. It's not for the faint-hearted, I'm just going to tell you that. But, you know, like it is very easy and, you know, you get everything that you need and it's very well explained, but it's a lot to take on. Is that just a snapshot in time? Can that change from month to month or does that give you a good indication of all the things you mentioned?
So these tests are very much like these tools that need to be used in the right hands, right? Like the surgical knife, you don't want to pick it up by the wrong end, which is why it's really helpful to use these tests with a trained practitioner that understands the various patterns of what is more persisting and what actually is that snapshot, as you mentioned. If you were having a particularly stressful week, you weren't chewing your food properly, your digestion is going to be affected, and maybe the next week you're feeling better and that's okay. And we know the microbiome, various things as well, can change quite quickly.
Now, I got a fairly clean bill of health, which was good. But when you get the results, there is an opportunity to talk about what's going on in life. And I think that's what's so interesting. And that's why you're doing what you're doing. So, you know, you can tell whether, as you say, somebody is sitting down and mindfully eating their meal and taking their time. And so few of us do that now. We're sort of rushing, we're mindlessly eating on the go, we're eating in front of the TV. So that can be it can be discussed. And I was able to see with my cortisol tests that it was coming up again in the evening. Now, I think that's mainly because I'm battling with kids that don't like to go to bed at 7 o'clock anymore and my time is not my own. And that does send my stress levels through the roof. But you were able to look at that and advise me on other ways then to wind myself down. So there's a lot more than just looking at the results. You can bring it into your everyday life.
Exactly that. So we're piecing everything together and it's very important to then say, okay, what were you doing that day? Was there a particular thing that was stressing you out? And as I said, making sense of everything.
So you said stress is something that people are coming to you for a lot and burnout. So what are you seeing in there and what's your advice to people?
I think it's very much a part of modern life, and we think of stress often as, you know, work pressures or constant thoughts and demands. But actually, there's just the stress of modern life, the fact that we're spending a lot of our days in stuffy rooms with artificial light, the kinds of toxins that have got into our food system. So there's a lot of these stresses that we might not even be aware of, and all of these actually act to increase the cortisol as well. So a lot of people, this has been going on for a while, to the extent that they might not even realize their body is stressed anymore because it's become their new norm.
And these sort of checks, is this something we should be having sort of biannually or annually? Or again, do we wait until we're having symptoms and until something doesn't quite feel right before we look for this sort of investigation?
So prevention is absolutely better than cure. A lot of these modern day illnesses that we're faced with develop many decades before the symptoms are manifesting. So the absolute dream is to have someone like you, Claire, who's passionate about their health and is willing to try and identify any things that they can fine tune and do better as early as possible. But at the same time, when we're young, fit and fighting, I do understand that's not the human tendency to want to act on things when we're not immediately faced with something. So most of the people that we do see in our clinic do have a myriad of different symptoms, digestive issues, fatigue, and we're able to help piece them all together. And what they thought was just a whole mix of things everywhere actually often roots back to one simple thing, such as they're not digesting their food adequately.
And we kind of get used to living at a certain way, don't we? Or in a certain way. So, you know, living at a 4 out of 10, we just think this is who I am. This is life. Life is stressful. Life is busy. But essentially, we know when something isn't quite right, or we know perhaps that something could change. And I think it's really important that people slow down and give themselves that chance to have that self-awareness to not just plow on.
I think that's absolutely spot on. That's one of the key things for our future health, is that self-awareness and being aware that that fight, flight, stress state often pushes us into wanting to do more, busy ourselves. And actually it's switching to that mode of being, tuning in with the sensations, how we're feeling. And then we start to be able to actually listen to those messages of the body, which is trying to tell us, okay, something does need to change here.
Now, you were at pains to say to me, and I just want to say this to other people, I mean, I was quite worried, you know, about what my results were going to be. And, you know, I care about health and well-being. So, you know, is this going to show in my results? There is no perfect result. Everybody's doing the best they can with where they're at.
Exactly that. And that's why I said around, it's much more around the patterns. We know in the research that it's still very early days in working out what exactly is a healthy microbiome. And, you know, for my own stool test as well, I have the parasite. It's called a parasite, but it's called Blastocystis hominis. And actually, some of the recent research shows that it can actually protect our health in certain ways by helping train the immune system to become more tolerant. Whereas for other people, it can cause more issues. So actually, I don't see it as a parasite. I feel like we have a good relationship. I'm not getting any symptoms. So I'm happy to let that be.
Sounds a bit like a free lodger to me. But anyway, you're right. It's all just information. It's all data acquisition to help us feel the best we possibly can. But if you want to find out more about True Health, go to True Health, spelled T-R-U, truehealth.co. Dr. Sally Bramley, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Brother Richard is back with another book, which is more balm for the soul. It's called Calming the Storm, and it's just what the doctor ordered for the modern world. And he joins me in studio now. Well, you're very welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again.
So your last book, Still Points, became a bestseller. What was that experience like for you, putting that out into the world and everything that came with it?
It was a surprise. I suppose I had been slowly over maybe about 10 years or so putting reflective material out via social media, etc., and trying to put a modern twist on what we've always done, which is, as Capuchin Franciscans, one of our jobs is to kind of open the doors to contemplative practice to people. So having begun work with the social media end of things through work I was doing at the time in UCC, that kind of expanded and went on, and then people came forward and said, particularly after the lockdown poem, the poem that went viral, that they wanted a book of this material. So that was Still Points, and it went out and it was very well received indeed, much to my shock, I suppose.
So was a second book always in your mind?
Well, I suppose Still Points was a collation of stuff that was momentary reflections. It was made for dipping into more than anything else. And what was coming back to me after Still Points came out was a lot of people saying, yeah, this is wonderful, but we want the how of it. We want the deeper stuff. So that's where Calming the Storms comes from. It's an attempt to kind of invite people into a deeper journey and a way of maybe creating a practical practice for themselves in the midst of their day.
So let's talk about the storms then, because you opened the book with the introduction, and I've just told you before we started recording, when I read those initial few passages, I had to kind of put the book down and have a moment, because I think we're all feeling it. You open with looking at everything that's going on in the world, from war to climate change to the age of distraction to capitalism, and there's so much pressure on everybody at every one time.
Yeah, I think you do very well if you get to the end of that section without having to put the book down for a moment. A lot of people have said that it's almost a kind of a description of sort of the background feeling of our lives at the moment. The background music is a music of overwhelm. The music is maybe too much, too loud, and too many stations are playing at once. Yeah.
But I think we feel helpless. So I read on because I'm like, great, what do we do with all of this? I'm going to ask you to read a paragraph from that. So that's the backdrop. You've literally touched on everything that's going on with us right now. And then you say,
I say, from all of the above, it should be obvious to us that the human being is not meant to live in this way, to be battered by these storms constantly. We are simply not able to process this much information and trauma, both individually and collectively, when not even two generations ago, the vast majority of us lived in much smaller communities with a far quieter, more stable life, often nearer to nature and to the cycles of life and death and the seasons.
And we have come so far away from that, haven't we? And to my shame, Brother Richard, I felt that you might be immune to that in your monastery bubble, but you're feeling it just as much as the rest of
us. Absolutely. I think humanity is humanity. And it always kind of has its due, no matter where we are, no matter what kind of life we're living. So yeah, the pressures can make their way even through the walls of the monastery at times. And particularly where I'm living at the moment, which is Dublin 7, inner city Dublin, where we do a lot of work with a lot of the problems of the time. We have our day centre for the homeless there that many people will know. I'm also involved with an ecological contemplative project that is taking place with our friary up in northwest Donegal. So those two projects really speak to a lot of the problems that are going on at the moment. And I find myself in the midst of the storms like everybody else.
You've also over the years worked a lot with young people and you talk a lot about the pressures on them, particularly in a digital age, them being thrust into a world that perhaps they're not ready for, that none of us seem to be ready for. And yet here we are swimming in it.
Yeah, the day I became really aware of that was a young person who'd been going through some bullying in school. And at the time, you know, the usual advice was being given, obviously, to report it and to the school would deal with it, etc. And the young girl, she was about 14, 15, she said to us, you don't get it. You don't understand. Should I go home from school? I close the hall door. I go up to my room. I close the bedroom door and the bully is with me in my bedroom. And that's when it really became apparent to me that, okay, we have given all of this freedom and all of this information and all of those things are good in and of themselves. But we haven't taught people how to deal with these things in a reflective way, in a mindful way, how to sort of discern what's good and what's bad in between. I think there was a famous writer, sadly not myself, but said, we opened the libraries of the world, but we forgot to put a librarian in place. And I think that's really one of the key elements for the overwhelm that a lot of young people are experiencing in the digital world.
When it comes to the news feed at the minute and everything we're receiving from, for the first time, watching genocide happen in real time to the talk of the climate crisis, and for the two to be coexisting seems crazy that we're not coming together as a globe. In fact, we're starting to separate out even more. On the one hand, I like to feel hopeful that we are more aware and awake to this than ever before, and that slowly there's a movement starting to say no more of this, but it can be very difficult not to just get bogged down. And I suppose that's at the centre of your teachings, isn't it?
And that's the idea, is that, okay, we have to be aware of the greater situations, the wider world, etc. We have to know what's going on. But in the end, what the reflective practices, not just of my own faith, but of all the faiths would teach, is you begin with what's in front of you. You begin with the moment at hand. You begin with the person you're encountering here and now. And if you bring a kind of a reflective lens to that, a compassionate lens to that, then that has a ripple effect. One of the great meditative fathers in our own tradition used to say that if you attain peace in your own heart first, then 1,000 around you are saved in that moment, because the ripple goes out. So our problem is, at the moment, we're just in a receptive mode where we're receiving all of this, but we don't have, if you like, the technology of the mind, the heart and the spirit that actually enables us to process it, deal with it, at least at the local level, at the very local level, and then begin a change from the local point of view, where I can say as an individual, okay, today, in this moment, what can I do so as to live peacefully, compassionately myself, and extend that peace and compassion to all of those that I encounter?
Because I suppose the cynic would say, you know what, I'm just going to sit and do a bit of breathing and a bit of meditation. What difference is that going to make? Surely I need to be vexed. I need this angst and this energy to do something.
Absolutely, we do need that. The difficulty is, if we just have the vexation and the angst and we don't have the reflection on the why of the vexation and the angst, we're just left in a bubble that can completely kind of circles around and creates a sort of a pattern of anger and then depression, because the energy doesn't get out. When we put the reflective pieces in place, when we put the bit of meditation in place or the reflective stance in place, then we realize the why of the angst, and then that goes outward into compassionate action rather than just anger or frustration.
You speak in the book of compassion fatigue. That's not something I'd heard about. Mm. Can you explain that a little?
Again, if we go back to what I was saying in the book there, that we were used up to a couple of generations ago of having, you know, kind of smaller communities, and there weren't as much demands made on our compassion constantly. And so the human being, no matter what resource we're talking about, whether it's compassion or peace or love or whatever, we're finite, you know, and we need to restore ourselves, just like the muscles wear down in the body and we need to eat well and sleep well so as to create, you know, good bodily health. In exactly the same way, mental and emotional health requires space. And it also requires those moments when we switch off the phone or we switch off the television for a while and we say, okay, I'm going to actually just allow restoration to take place first. A very old spiritual principle is, you cannot pour from an empty cup. You know, nemo dat quod non habat, we used to be told as novices, which was, you can't give what you don't have yourself. So there is a restoration of self first, which isn't selfish. It's restoring oneself so as to be able to then serve better. And I think if we don't have those spaces in place, then that's when compassion fatigue fits in. And we just become kind of hopeless and we fall back into ourselves in a kind of a self-centered way then.
In the book, you go through four ancient paths: intention, attention, compassion and wisdom. Mm. Can you talk a little bit to those and why they're the headings?
So we call those the four directions of contemplative practice. And the idea is that just like you have four cardinal points and a compass that orient you, you know, as to where you are with regard to north, south, east and west, these kind of four ancient practices were seen as essential to sort of create the reflective contemplative person in the world. And I use that word specifically because we tend to use the word mindful an awful lot at the moment. It's almost overused. But mindfulness was only meant to be the first step on a contemplative journey to deeper awareness. And all of the traditions that teach mindfulness would say that: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, etc. So these four broad directions then, intentionality begins with actually, you know, deciding how I am going to live, actively choosing as opposed to being an object in the relationship rather than actually being a subject. So I decide, and that might be expressing moments of intentionality for myself. Our primary moment in our practice is the first moment of consciousness in the day, when we wake in the day actually deciding, this is how I'm going to be, this is how I choose to live my life in this day. Attention then are the mindful practices. It's actually tuning into the present moment at hand and recognizing that choice, moral choice, the choice between good and ill, exists for us as a human being only in the moment at hand. We don't have the past except as a way of learning from, and the future hasn't happened yet. So we try through attentiveness practices to dwell as deeply as we can in the present moment. And spiritually, we would go deeper in the Christian tradition and say the present moment is actually the place of divine encounter. We speak of it as an eighth sacrament in the Catholic faith. Like, we have the seven sacraments people are familiar with: going to church, baptism, Eucharist, marriage, etc. But the eighth sacrament traditionally was taught in the mystical tradition as being just the present moment at hand. That me being fully attentive to the conversation here with you, there is a sacramental character to that. There is divinity revealing divinity in the two people and in their encounter. And that means that we then enter into all relationships with an experience of reverence and respect first. They're the first steps that we walk into. The understanding that I am going to receive encounter with the divine or the ultimate truth or whatever name you want to put on it in the other person. So that means I don't immediately run in to impose my view on the other. My role becomes a role of listening and attending and sort of finding where that's acting. So that's intention and attention, and they're the sort of the initial building blocks. And then we have compassion, which we've been talking about. So hopefully well reflected upon action goes out that isn't exhausting, that isn't going to drive the person into kind of a compassion despair or compassion fatigue. But we actually look at what can I do in this moment? How can I benefit the world and all the beings within the world in this moment? And if we take it right down to the present moment like that, it becomes somewhat manageable. It's not about me fixing the world. It's about me recognizing that if I'm going to be compassionate here and now, that may mean looking after the person in front of me. Wonderful. It may also mean turning my eyes internally and saying, well, what do I need in this moment? And the last of the directions then is wisdom, which is hopefully what arises within us if we practice the three regularly. And so wisdom is the great fruit of it. We hopefully begin to turn into what all the traditional societies have said was the goal of a human being, which is the idea of a wise person, a sage, a holy person, if you want to call it that, but maybe not the way most people think of holiness, more a kind of a whole person, a person who has attained balance in their life.
The first thing in the morning really grabbed me, and you asked the question, do you wake with meaning and purpose or do you go straight to your to-do list? And because now we don't need to be at the desk necessarily to be logged into work, it's very easy to go straight into...
Yeah, the bully's in the bedroom, but it's the phone with all of the tasks. So actually choosing, that's where the intention bit comes in, choosing the moment. Now, I mean, people wake and they live very, very busy lives, and they might have, you know, children that need to be minded, or as you're saying, at work or career or job, or the phone is buzzing already. And the first thing we reach for is the list of what did we miss during the night? You know, what did we lose out on along the way? So just choosing to take, it only has to be a couple of seconds, but to actually sit at the side of the bed, put the feet on the floor, feel yourself grounded and actually enter the day by choosing it, you know. One of our old brothers used to say that there are two ways of entering the day. One is to say, you know, good morning, God. We open ourselves to the ultimate, the transcendent, whatever way we want to see meaning expressed in our life. And the other way is to say, good God, it's morning. You know, I'm starting off again. Here I go again. So we have a physical practice that we do traditionally in our order, which is when we get out of the bed in the morning, when the alarm goes, the first thing we do is to kneel down and kiss the ground. And the idea behind that is to say, thank you. I have another day. I have another day of practice, another day in which I get to begin again. St. Francis used to say to the brothers, begin again every day. And so if we begin to look at the morning as new beginning, then we can begin to orient the day from that moment of intention.
And we forget that, don't we? We forget what a gift it is to throw your legs out the other side of the bed, to stand. Anyone going through illness or lying in a hospital bed right now would give anything
sure. To
wake with that. And when we get up and get into to-do mode,
yeah,
we forget. And to start on that positive carries on into the day.
We speak of a supernatural amnesia that we all go through, which is we have these big events, maybe traumatic events, maybe joyful events, whatever, that restore a sense of meaning. And it's, I'll never forget this. You know, I'm going to begin again with joy every day. And then the following Monday comes around and that's forgotten. It fades. So that's why daily practice becomes important, because we're tuning the signal in every time. We're tuning the radio back in to that signal of kind of meaning and purpose, so that when we do get up day to day, when we do sit with, you know, the food on the table, when we do recognize, I can switch a light on and the light comes on. You know, I can turn the tap and the water comes out. And that's one of the things that seeing what's going on in the rest of the world can actually do. It can restore not just a sense of I need to act on behalf of those who are in need, which is very important, but also there's a reflective practice back, which is, and I need to have gratitude for what I have. And if those, both of those are there, then the compassion fatigue doesn't happen.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
We were talking about daily practice and how that builds over time to really become part of who you are. It's certainly, you know, something that's huge in your life, but you don't have to be a Franciscan monk to have daily practice.
Not at all.
And you gave a great analogy in the book of how the brain works, and say learning to play an instrument or drive a car, and it's very difficult at the start and then it slips into our subconscious and we do it without even thinking. There's loads of times I pull into the driveway and realise I didn't stop for the milk on the way because I was on autopilot.
Yeah.
And we can be on autopilot in life, can't we? And we can be stuck in patterns that aren't serving us and we don't even know. You spoke about a labyrinth and that we've walked ourselves into trenches that we haven't even noticed.
So the old medieval understanding of the human brain, and I suppose it's one of those things where if you even look at the brain to some extent, it kind of looks like a labyrinth. Now, a labyrinth isn't a maze. You don't get lost in a labyrinth. A labyrinth is about a deliberately chosen path that you take that slows you down. So if any of your listeners have done labyrinth practices in many places, some of the great European cathedrals used to have them as a way of slowing down before you entered in. They were considered so important, in fact, at one stage, that they were seen as having equal spiritual benefit as the practice of pilgrimage, for example, where we also kind of go away and slow ourselves down and take some sacred time out. But the labyrinth idea is to walk more deeply with reflective practice in my own life. So I begin to spot the patterns that maybe used to be useful, maybe used to serve me well, but maybe don't anymore. And a lot of the neurobiology around trauma, for example, would also talk about this, how we slip very easily into practices that were maybe to keep us safe at a particular time or to keep us calm. We discover them as ways of self-regulating along the way. And then life changes, circumstances change, you know, and we change as well. But the patterns remain. The big example of this I remember seeing myself was and I mentioned it in the book, was while I was living in Carlow. We used to have a community in Carlow. I was living there towards the very start of our training. And we used to be sent across to help out and volunteer in, it was an institution for those who had experienced psychiatric illness and psychiatric problems. Now, the building had been there for a very long time and it used to have big high walls all around it. And then thankfully, 1960s, 70s, 80s came, the walls were taken down, the place was beautifully landscaped, etc. And there was much more of an effort to reintegrate the people who were living there back into the community. But those who'd been there for a very long time, you'd see them out for a walk and they would walk exactly where the walls used to be. The walls weren't there anymore, but they would walk exactly where the walls used to be. They would make kind of 90 degree turns where the corners used to be. A town and a community were waiting just outside. They were totally free to go wherever they wanted to go. But as far as they were concerned, the walls still existed because they had repeated that over and over again for years and years and years. And slowly people had to work with them to kind of get their courage again to step beyond where the walls used to be. And that image always remains with me when we talk about this, because a lot of us are living behind invisible walls. Walls we're not even aware of. And so the meditative practice allows us to begin to sit back, to examine our day, to examine, you know, why do I always react to that person in that way? Why do I always find myself reaching for that food or that drink whenever I'm stressed or worried, you know? And when we go back to those original moments, the moments that sort of began those things with awareness, we can begin to ask very simple questions. And they're not threatening. It's a simple question like, is this useful anymore? Is this helping me anymore? And when we get the truthful answer to that, there's an awful lot that can be jettisoned. Thomas Merton, the great American mystic, said beautifully many years ago that for those of us, please God, we'll all be among them, but for those of us who get through the door of heaven, we'll be amazed at how little of what we thought of as ourselves makes it through the door. In other words, we have this big accretion all around us, like an oyster that creates, you know, the pearl inside or builds the shell slowly around itself. And a lot of that accretion are the patterns we've picked up, the things that we have been told we should do, should believe, etc. And so meditative practice allows us to sit down, no matter who we are, in whatever tradition we're in, and begin to ask what's truthful, what's real, what's needed, and to begin to rearrange, to reprogram the self in that way.
And that's one of the big misconceptions around meditation, isn't it? That you're trying to clear your mind, you're trying to sit with nothing in your head, whereas really you want to become aware of the thoughts. It's the awareness you're trying
exactly,
to get to.
Exactly. I know a lot of people who gave up meditation because they thought it will take the thoughts away. And then they go into a silent room and they sit for a while and they're just alone with the thoughts and it becomes worse. As one woman said to me after a mindfulness course, you know, before I knew I was broken, now I'm mindful that I'm broken, but nothing has changed. And actually a lot had changed because she had now realized that we are not our feelings. We are not our thoughts. There is an internal observer that can stand back from all of those things. Yes, we'll always have them. They'll always move and they'll always be part of it. But one of the things I teach, which is very important, is to recognize that the distractions in the mind are actually necessary for the honing of meditative practice. So we need the distractions because every time I notice I'm distracted and return to the meditative practice, I'm building kind of mental muscle. You know, it's like going to the gym and lifting a weight and putting it down again, lifting a weight and putting it down. Over time, the muscle builds. But if I don't put it down and then lift it up, if I'm just holding the weight the whole time, nothing will happen. And if I'm just putting the weight down and not lifting at all, nothing will happen. So I need that recognition of I'm distracted, I return. I'm distracted, I return. Without judgment and without getting upset by the fact that I'm distracted, because it's part of our human nature to be distracted most of the time. But once I begin to know that those thoughts are constantly flowing, that those emotions are constantly flowing, then I can stand back from them and actually choose which ones I want to interact with.
And it starts to bleed into your everyday, I notice, when my practice is consistent. If I get angry in traffic, I question, why did I react in that way? Oh, did I have lunch or am I upset about something? You know, and you start to tune in with yourself and it's that awareness. And you've lots of brilliant practices and, you know, start-offs for people and questions to ask themselves and ways they can bring it into their everyday. I wanted to end perhaps on the importance of connection and how we're moving into a sort of an individual tunnel vision instead of that importance of community. And you talk about liminality. That's a word I never came across before. And you suggest going to a cafe and really taking in our surroundings. And that was really mind-blowing to me without necessarily building a narrative over who's saying what and why.
Yeah.
And we tend to do that, don't we?
Yeah, we immediately impose narrative. You know, story comes in, judgment comes in straight away. But community is actually built more from that ability to stand back and not to put my ego and my story into the midst of everything. You know, that it's not about we're going to sit around so people can hear me. It's we're going to sit around to see what happens, to see what actually arises within that moment. I remember traveling on a bus in London and you know, it was the usual thing, a long bus journey, and everybody was on their phone. And being absolutely honest, I would probably have been on my phone myself, but I had left my phone in my luggage. So I was looking out the window and we were passing one of these beautiful little parks that you get around these squares in London. And there was a gentleman, a park keeper, the real old style, the peaked cap, the whole lot, but he was using a leaf blower. And as he was using the leaf blower, the pigeons were all around him and he began to dance while he was using the leaf blower. He was just having a little moment by himself, totally unaware that somebody on a double story bus was able to see in. And I looked and enjoyed it. And I turned around to the rest of the bus to do that whole catch somebody else's eye and have the moment of connection. And isn't it wonderful? Aren't we all seeing it? And nobody else had seen it. And the bus pulled away. Now, I'm not judging the people on the phones because, as I say, I would probably have been one of them. But it really woke me up to the fact that what are we missing? What are we actually missing? So liminality is about saying, what am I missing? Stand back and, you know, watch the children play at home. You know, stand back and actually look at the partner you're with. Catch the eye of the colleague across the desk. You know, to go to the cafe and sit and allow space to happen around you so that you're not dug into the phone or the book necessarily or whatever. And they're all good things to do in their own way. But to lift our gaze is a hugely important thing because then we're met by the gaze of others. And once we're actually looking eye to eye with people, what we find is a lot of difference passes away. Conversation begins to happen and we begin to discover, actually, my life is very similar to yours. Yours is very similar to mine. We all went to bed last night. We all got up this morning. We all have lists of things that we'd like to get done by the end of the day. And we're all going to need food and drink somewhere in the day as well. So if we start with the basics, the human basics, then that can evolve into kind of recognizing the other as brother or sister, first and foremost. And that's actually the essence of the Franciscan vision.
And I know you do a lot of work with the Sanctuary here in Dublin. It's a Focus Ireland centre and you've worked many times with the homeless. And that's something they say they miss if you're on the street. I mean, yes, they're missing a roof over their head and lots of other things, but it's that eye contact with people
it's
and that
the first
connection.
Thing that disappears. You know, once somebody is on the street, anybody will tell you this, you know, and I mean, you can try it for yourself. But if you're on the street and looking like you're in need, it's amazing how quickly you lose the gaze of others. You vanish. You are pushed to the edge rather than choosing the edge. And an awful lot of those people would say over time that, you know, even for someone to stop and say to them, I don't have anything at the moment, you know, sorry, that meant more to them. I was in the car the other day, stopped, and there was a gentleman coming along, you know, begging from the cars. And you can see the frustration of people and sometimes the fear as well. And that's totally understandable when somebody is kind of coming into a private space. You know, the car can be a very safe private space for people. But as he passed along, I lowered the window and I said, look, I actually don't have anything at the moment. But, you know, I told him about our day centre, if he wanted to go and have some food there. And we spoke for the minute and a half before the traffic moved. But as I was moving out, he put the hand in the car just to do a fist bump and said, "Thanks." And that's all it was. Now, I'm not saying to people, open your windows or talk to people. What I am saying is, don't be afraid to meet eye to eye. Don't be afraid to actually say hello. Don't be afraid that you're going to be drawn in to something. Because if somebody asks you for something you can't give, just tell them you can't give. What you'll have given them is a moment of human encounter, and that might be the only moment they have of that the whole day.
And you reminded me of there's always somebody, sadly, at the car park where I park here close to News Talk. And there was a new guy there and I offered to buy him something to eat. And he actually asked, he said, "Look, I know this is really cheeky, but could I have a packet of cigarettes?"
Yeah.
Now, my kids said I did the wrong thing because how can I be a health coach and buy somebody cigarettes? But I did.
Yeah.
I said, "Sure." And I came back and he said, "Look, you're so kind. What's your name?"
Yeah.
And it really kind of... And I said, "Oh, you know," because I was kind of heading on, you know, back about my business. And I said, I'm Claire." And he said, "I'm Aaron."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, really nice to meet you, Aaron." And we locked eyes. And that's what we're missing, isn't
absolutely.
It? It was a moment human to human.
Yeah.
And that's where the compassion will grow. And all the overwhelm we feel from the storm, that's the little bit that we should try and build. That's the flame.
100%. And it's easy and we can all do it. It doesn't matter who we are. We can all do it.
Yeah. And I don't give that example. I mean, I'm not perfect. I've hurried by many person looking for charity or...
Yeah.
But it was the moment and I felt it and you reminded me of it in the book. Can I ask you finally, you lean in, obviously, you're a Franciscan monk, to scripture a lot. But do you think that anybody, I hope by this conversation, they've realised that this is all impacting everyday life and everyday people. But do you think people who aren't religious can still get something out of this book?
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. And it's not a book to try and proselytise or convert. What it is an open door where people can begin to discover maybe the richness of a tradition that they were unaware of or that they didn't realise actually had a kind of a mystical contemplative side to it as well. But for all of those who are, you know, saying, "Well, I'm happy to do meditation, I'm not happy to do anything else," just do it. Just actually be with the breath, be with the truth of your own being, be with the journey that you are currently making and try and open yourself to compassion. I think those four words, intention, attention, compassion and wisdom, are four that anybody of any faith or none could sign up to and say, you know, "I'd like to live my life according to those four practices." And if you do that, then that's, you know, a new beginning.
And look, it's certainly needed, as we've discussed. It is called Calming the Storms, Meditation as a Path to Inner Peace and Happiness. Brother Richard, thank you for writing it and for this conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
So that is it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and to Simon Keane, and to Hugo Da Silva Scott, who is on sound. And thanks as ever to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.